Welcome to Record Roulette. My name is Eamon O'Flynn, and I'm here with Nathan Smith to discuss another album from the Rolling Stone 500 Greatest Albums list that we've chosen sort of at random. Sonia Walton is away for this episode, but we filled her space with an incredible guest. Adam Rogers is a science and tech journalist. He's currently the senior tech correspondent at Insider, but I first came across his work when he was an editor and writer at Wired. Oh, and he's also the author of two books, the New York Times bestseller, Proof, The Science of Booze, which is right up my alley, and more recently, Full Spectrum, How the Science of Color Made Us Modern. Why in the world did you accept my offer to join us, Adam?
because let's see. Here's the facile answer. You know how you're supposed to do stuff that's like outside your comfort zone? Well, I'm actually not great with music. It's a lacuna in my the stuff that I love. I'm not obsessive about it. There's music that I like, and then there's other music. But I'm not expert in it. I'm not a hobbyist. You know, I acquire new music only idiosyncratically when at all. And so I don't have a lot of that in my head. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to have weird chats, man. That's the less facile answer. I just like talking about, it's like, oh, okay. Yeah, no, that's fun to talk about. Sure. Well, let's do that.
And I think, you know, really that's why this podcast exists, to have weird chats and to talk about music. The whole thing started because I was like, well, I'm not really a big, you know, music encyclopedia or anything myself. So why don't I force myself to listen to stuff? And you'd be amazed how often I start an episode by saying, well, I've never even heard of this artist before, or something along those lines. And it's like Janet Jackson or something.
Right. Well, no, I've heard of Janet Jackson. The other thing, this is a little bit, I don't know what this is, but the new editor, the new-ish editor of Rolling Stone, using the Rolling Stone top 500 albums, and they're a big list place, and they're doing great journalism too. The editor of Rolling Stone is Noah Schachtman. Noah and I worked together. I was his editor when he was a military technology blogger back at Wired almost 20 years ago, and I was his features editor too. So, you know, so I have that connection now to like, Rolling Stone. And that was, music was the other thing that he did. He'd been in bands, and we actually went out in New York to see jazz once. And so I'm more connected to actual Rolling Stone than I am
music
that it covers. Yeah. Journalism networking, basically all that is. So
I asked you to pick an album from the several hundred that we haven't covered yet, and you decided on Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits, which came out in 1985 and comes in at number 418 on the Rolling Stone 500 Greatest Albums list. This is the weird thing. So you made this choice, and then the message you sent, you said, I have some things to say about this album, and I can't tell if that's a positive or a negative. So what made you pick this particular album?
It is a positive, right? Number 418 with a bullet. So here, when you presented the way you presented the rules of the game was, mm-hmm, like, okay, we'll spin the random number generator, and then we'll go listen to whatever that comes up if you haven't done it already on the show, and we'll go, mm-hmm, from there. And I was like, okay, fine. And then I spun the random number generator, and an album came up that I just didn't care about. I mean, it was fine. I'm sure it's really good, actually. But I was like, I'm not going to have anything to say about that. I'm going to listen to it, and it's going to be like me tapping along and like, yep, that sure is music, you know, and either I will say like, yeah, that's pretty good. I really like that. Or I'll be like, yeah, that wasn't for me, but it'll be boring. It'll be a boring conversation. That's what'll happen. I'll be boring about it. And then we went back and forth a bunch of times. Well, why don't you? Actually, we didn't go back and forth. You just kept sending me emails.
I just kept sending emails, and I was like, please. Hey, this guy's, yeah, a journalist. I just need to keep throwing emails at him, getting that inbox, and eventually you'll get a response.
And it worked. That works. That's good. Good comms training is what that is. And so I finally, you finally said, like, will you just go look at the list and see if there's anything on there that pings any sort of, has any resonance for you at all, right? And I did. And so I went through the list. And down there, you know, down at number 418 was Brothers in Arms. Brothers in Arms, this is the positive part, the things I have to say about it. Brothers in Arms was, in a real sense, the first album I bought. It was the first album that I cared about. So I had other music before that, and because it came out, I was 15 when it came out. And, you know, there was other, my family, my parents listened to music, we had music in the house, you know, there were other, but the first album, like, I cared enough about to buy, I think, on cassette first. And then the first album I bought on CD was Brothers in Arms. And it, I actually, like, I really, it's one of the few albums where I understand when people get music, that they love music. It's not just that I like it fine. I really loved this album. And still do. Like, I still think it's a great album. I thought it was great then. I still think it's pretty great. Having just listened to it a few times, you know, in preparation for this. And I think I kind of know why, a little bit, other than just it was an album that was a big deal at that formative moment that all of us have when the universe is deciding what kind of music is like in our heads, we're going to be like, well, that's music. There's other things that are musical, but like, there's a thing that's music and it's that, and it's what you grok to when you're 15. Right. So this one was mine. Yeah. And I think that's sort of interesting. That's fascinating for me to kind of play with.
We come back to that. That actually happens more often than, well, maybe you might imagine it happens quite often, but we have a lot of people who have been on the show who do remember the album from when they were kids, or, you know, certainly at an earlier point in their lives, and it just hit them a certain way at that time. And they go back wondering, is this going to sound the same? I haven't really thought about this for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, you know, like, is this album from The Cure? We did a Cure album recently. Is this album from The Cure going to be the same as when I heard it back in the late 80s? And so, it's a good way. I love that Cure album, and you know, I think this album has made me reevaluate how I think about the 80s just generally, because we've had so consistently albums that I actually like quite a lot, and I'm in no way versed in music from the 80s. Everything I loved was from the 60s and 70s, because that's what my parents listened to, and then I was good for the 90s onwards, and so the 80s kind of got forgotten. And so this is just building this, along with Madonna, along with The Cure, is just building this interesting little, you know, quilt, this tapestry of different experiences that I'd never had before.
And I would say my parents listened to 60s and 70s music when I was a kid. And I mean, 70s music was contemporary music when I was, because I was born in 1970, so that was around. And then 60s music wasn't that old, you know, when I was a kid. My dad didn't listen to them. My dad listened to mostly like classical stuff from a lot of different eras. My mom listened to 50s music too, that she remembered from when she was little. And so that was anything from your like early rock to like early Motown. And I'm very conscious now that when I'm in the car, if I have like the 80s station on with my kids in the car listening to it, that is the equivalent of when I was in the car at their age and my mom was playing music from the 50s and 60s. Like that, the numbers work, you know, of like what's the increment of age. So there's something going on with that, of what, you know, what music hits your soul and sticks when you're an adolescent and then you carry through. But I think I could make the argument, and I might do it here if you want to hear it, that like not all of it's good even though we love it. And I think some of it still 100%. Stays good. And so, like, you know, when Motown would come on, you know, when I was a kid, it's like, well, that was good then. It was good when it was contemporary. It was good when we were listening to it when I was a kid. It's good now, you know? And I think, you know, some of the 80s stuff you can listen to with a little bit of an ironic detachment if you're my age. And some of it I think genuinely stands up. I think not all of Madonna, but I think some of Madonna really holds up. It's like, no, that was great. It was great. There's a reason people thought it was great. That's great. Mm-hmm. This Dire Straits album, having done some reading about it now, is probably more controversial on the does it hold up gauge. But I will say that for me, it does. It really does.
Yeah. The thing I'll be doing that with my kids is like Green Day and Weezer and Blink-182. And, you know, I'm not sure it'll hold up quite as well as this album does to my mind, but you're right. And we've run into problems actually on this podcast with fandoms, right? Fandoms who are saying, whoa, 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 you can't say anything negative about this album or that album, or you don't like this thing about the style of music. you don't get to talk about that. You're not a fan. And it's like, it's art. You're allowed to talk about it. You're allowed to have opinions, and you're allowed to have different perspectives. And this is the way it is. And your perspective can change over time. And that's also allowed.
You know, the amount that I don't know about music and don't kind of connect with it the way a lot of people do is the exact amount that I do connect with movies and television and especially in science fiction and books. I'm familiar with how fandoms can go and how often they can become toxic in their
100%.
And I'm really a I'm very much a Star Trek person.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I'm first in line to say like, yeah, that movie that's not a good movie. Like, even love it and still be, and I think you have to do that because you have to engage with our fandoms in the same spirit that I think that we like engage with a critical world. Like, it's okay to be critical, you know, and mm-hmm. to say like well, I'll give you an example, and I think this is actually an important one, because I wanted to say it early from this album, from Brothers in Arms, actually. The biggest hit from this album is Money for Nothing, the song Money for Nothing, mm-hmm. in which Mark Knopfler uses what we would now say, rightly, is a horrifying slur.
Yep.
Used to apply to gay men, right? Like, he uses it essentially as a joke.
Yeah.
A thing that happened in the 80s, that people would use that slur.
Yep.
Casually, and it was fine with me then, stupidly, like,
yeah.
You know, that's not okay now, and I can't imagine that if he performs that song now, if he does it live, he says he that lyric the same way.
He says the word maggot, and he also he has to, I mean, it fits in the spot. But the other thing he said is the craziest thing, I read an interview where he said something along the lines of, you know, what I really wanted to say was motherfucker, but I didn't think that I could get away with that. So I put this other word, put this other one in instead, which seems looking back now, this much down the line, that seems totally nuts that wasn't allowed. But the word that's used is allowed. So that's, to me, that's
insane.
Yep.
Insane. And it actually put me in the mind of another kind of iconic 1980s moment, you know, Eddie Murphy's concert film Delirious. Which is the thing that he was sort of had become a giant star, and he makes this concert film, and it's a brilliantly funny, it's a nuclear bomb of comedy. Like, it's just mm-hmm. incredible how hard he kills, except one of the long bits in it is reliant on him saying that word again and again and again. In a horrifyingly homophobic way, not even just the sort of casually insulting way that Knopfler uses it in the song. Yeah. And it's still like, well, that, you know, that made him famous. People were, kids repeated that whole bit to each other, you know, in schoolyards. And you just like, well, okay, that was bad.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad that that's not cool anymore.
Yeah. I guess. Yeah. I think it's such a strange, like we've talked about, you know, in Knopfler's case, from what I've seen of him, he doesn't seem like he's a particularly terrible person or something like that. But we've covered people who are arguably absolutely horrifically terrible people, like James Brown. I said at one point, I think this story is he kicked a pregnant woman down a flight of stairs. Like, this is a guy who is held up at like the highest levels of, you know, greatness, and it's like his record is really terrible. And so anyway, it's a very, like, looking back, it's tough to kind of separate those and to separate where the world that he was in at the time. And like you said, it was acceptable, whether that was good or reasonable or not. It was an acceptable thing at the time, despite the fact that we know it's a bad, so when you do listen to something like this, it's like, it's hard to figure out how to deal with that song.
Yeah.
But
it's really true with artists, how to separate, if you should separate, how do you, you know, I guess all I can ever get to is that you have to look at it with clear eyes and say, like, that was really bad. He shouldn't have done it. And not even make, this isn't even really acceptable, I guess. I think, you know, it's especially weird because the B-side of the album is all like anti-military. It's all, you know, pleas for like not, mm-hmm. you know, he's opposed to the militarization that's going on in the world around him in the 80s, things like the Falkland War, like some of the other albums are, you know, trying to talk about what's happening to the British industrial areas in England, you know, as they're falling apart and people losing their jobs, like all these sort of politics that if you're at all progressive, you're like, those are good politics to have. So there's even a contrast there, like who is he and what's he doing. It's a lot less clear cut, as you say, than like, you know, James Brown or Miles Davis, you know, yeah. like brilliant musicians, horrible people.
All right, so let's get to the obvious question. If you were to recommend a boozy drink to pair with listening to Brothers in Arms, Adam, what would it be? I'm tossing back to the fact that you wrote Proof, the Science of Booze. You know everything about booze, as far as I'm concerned. What drink it pairs with Brothers in Arms?
Here's what I think. I think that this is a band that had this weird, even though they were English, like, you know, working class English guys, they were doing a riff on like American roots rock and country. So like what they wish people would be drinking is like a Budweiser with a Wild Turkey back, you know. But then what they, for most of their albums, what you actually would want to be drinking is like a pint of bitters, like pulled from the hand pull in the pub, you know, on a foggy mm-hmm. night in Manchester or whatever, until you get to Brothers in Arms, which is this like threshold 1980s sounding album. So I feel like it really needs a 1980s drink. Mm-hmm. So I almost want to go Strawberry Daiquiri, which to me is sort of the iconic, you know, like frozen Strawberry Daiquiri, you know, or a Long Island iced tea maybe. And I think maybe like in a way the Long Island iced tea might kind of bridge all of the gaps, because it has some of that working class American vibe, but it has a lot of distilled spirits in it, in fact almost all of them. But maybe it gets at like what it's like to be in a pub. So I might, I don't know, now I'm talking myself out of the daiquiri. Yeah, I might go Long Island iced tea with this one, just for the 80s-ness of it.
All right,
I'm gonna stick with that. Yeah, I'm gonna go with that.
All right. Nathan, you've been extremely patient here. So no more booze questions for the rest of this episode here, but Nathan,
what am I going to talk about?
Did you know anything about this album before you took a listen, and did you like it?
Like many bands we've covered on this series, like I was familiar with Dire Straits, obviously, but they weren't a band that I sort of dove headlong into albums. So I'd heard, you know, I'd obviously heard Money for Nothing a zillion times. I could hear it a zillion times more because it's still so modern sounding, and it doesn't get old to me, even though it is a hit that I've heard a million times. Heard of Sultans of Swing and several others on this album I'd recognize, but I'd never, you know, listened to an album from beginning to end, and I certainly hadn't listened to this one. And, you know, I liked it. I thought it was good. I thought it was a good listen. I listened to it several times, but I didn't love it. And I think the point that we had earlier that certain albums that you hear at certain points of your life have that sort of X factor for a variety of reasons, where even if you listen to it 20 or 30 years later, and I think of albums from my own sort of youth or childhood around that time, even if I don't like them as much, they still make you feel a certain way. And that's enough to kind of bridge the gap, where even if musically it's kind of lessened a bit, that feeling, which is such an intrinsic part of how you connect with music, that feeling is still there, and it brings you back to this really special time. So for me, that didn't exist for this album, because I sort of found it, you know, in the last few weeks. So I liked it. I thought it was good. It's certainly not a bad album. I think Mark Knopfler is a fantastic guitarist. I think there's some interesting songs on here, but I for some reason, I was expecting, I don't know, I was expecting it to be a bit more adventurous than it was. Like, again, it's a really good album, really good songs, but I didn't feel like they were sort of paving any new ground or sort of charting a course that would then lead to XYZ in the late 80s and early 90s. It sort of sounded of its time, very good album of its time, but it was sort of, for me, that and that's it.
That's, I think, really, that's really perceptive, I think, because it doesn't, it doesn't open up a different channel for what music was going to be like for the next decade. Mm-hmm. It it walks right into what music was like for the next decade. Like, that's what it was all. This is 85. It was already beginning to sound like that. You know, and this sort of, you know, catches like this lightning of everything that was good about Dire Straits coming into this moment, plus what was going on with kind of the production of the actual production of music and what the 80s zeitgeist was, goes into this album. And then it sort of destroys them. Like, they get one more studio album. It blows them up as a band because they get so popular. Like,
and technically they actually break up after this album. They go on a tour. They basically say, like, nope, done with this. This is ridiculous. We don't want this anymore. And then come back together for one last hurrah, which also just absolutely destroys all of their personal relationships and relationships with each other. And the tour destroys them physically and mentally. I had no clue what to expect. And again, I've said this on, I'd say 90% of the albums we've covered, where I'm like, I don't know what Velvet Underground's going to sound like. I don't know what Lou Reed's going to sound like. And then I was mystified to find out that they were related in some way. But with this, I had no clue what to expect. I knew the name. I knew the name of the artist. That's basically it. I'd heard the name Mark Knopfler before. But this really surprised me, because it is in this sweet spot for me, I think, too. You know, like, I talk about a lot the fact that two of my favorite artists or groups are The Band and Bob Seger. And I think that they strive for a type of rock and roll, like going backwards toward rock and roll. And I think the first, well, certainly, you know, the second song on this album is that. And, you know, there's a lot of that here. It doesn't feel like it's, as you said, it's not pushing things forward. It's not like looking at what's going to happen 10, 15 years down the line. It's not that type of album, but it really resonated with the type of music that I enjoy. So I ended up really liking the album. And honestly, after I listened to it a couple of times, I was surprised. I usually listen to these things a couple of times first, and then I start reading about them. I want to try and get my own feel for it. And I was actually very surprised to learn that Mark Knopfler was ranked number 27 on Rolling Stone's list of 100 greatest guitarists of all time. Do you think that he lives up to that reputation on this album, Adam?
I'm not super qualified to make that assessment, but I will say that I think that his playing on Money for Nothing, especially, like, that when his guitar comes in, you know, at the beginning of that song, that is a transportive musical moment to me. You know,
yeah.
Like, that's just like, oh damn, that happens, and it's a drop. Like, something's about to happen in that song. And, you know, I read something that he was trying to sound like ZZ Top. It's like, yeah, it does sound like another, you know, those guys, other great guitarist of all time, right? Like, it's like, yeah, that's, there is something in that sound and the way that it was produced where there's a for me, and I don't have a lot of these. Some people have a lot of them. I don't have a lot of them. I'm like, oh, like, yeah. Oh, attention must be paid right now. Because of his musicianship, you know, I have a pal, one of my best friends is a professional musician. And we were college roommates, and so I've known him for a long time. And he has this theory about 80s music that he says, you know, a lot of people will talk about kind of shitty commodity 80s music pop, you know. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of this weird bridge of rock and pop, and people accused it of that then, and they'll talk about it now. And he'll say, like, all that stuff in the 80s that people talk about is like dumb pop, but we still listen to it, not just those of us who were adolescents then, but other people. Yep. It's a genre, right? Because he says it's because even if the songs were fine, you know, they were good pop music, the musicianship on the songs, the session guys who played on the albums, were so good that even if you don't know anything about music, don't know much about music like me, like, there's still, it's like, it's different. It's not just some, like, now I'm an old man being dismissive. It's not just some kid who's like a DJ, you know, who's like producing on a Macintosh, you know. Yeah. It's actually like people who were really, really good. And if you read, you did the same thing I did. You go back and read like what happened when they were recording this album and who they brought in, you know, and bringing in the right drummer. And like the person they brought in on keyboards, who brought in for the first time on a Dire Straits album, brought in like the Yamaha DX7, right? The sound of the 1980s, the first like widely used digital synthesizer. And you listen to these songs, you're like, oh, right. These are people who know what they're doing. That's why these songs are good, because they know what, even if this, they're like perfectly fine, the emotions or whatever. I mean, I don't know, like I'm no stuff, but if you get poetical about it, they're like, yeah, that's a pretty good pop song, but damn, they can play their instruments.
Yeah, that's true. Nathan, is he a guitar god? Is that?
Well, I'm also not really qualified to say whether he is or isn't, but in my own sort of personal evaluation of what makes a good or a great, in this case, guitar player, is how many different styles they can play with certain degree of dexterity. But I think also more important than that is whether they are show off guitar players or whether they play for the song and kind of show their virtuosity in that way. And I think Mark Knopfler does that. Like, he's clearly a guy who could and does in some cases play anything he wants to. Like, I've got no doubt he could be, you know, a Van Halen type who's just going all over the fretboard and just playing all like a million notes a second. But he doesn't do that more often than not because the songs don't require it. And so he's got that discipline and that restraint to sort of demonstrate how good he is by not showing off just for the sake of showing off. Like, he's got acoustic guitar, he's got some, you know, reggae feel, he's got the hard rock, he's got the riffs, he's got the little kind of subtle, you know, arpeggios. Like, he can do it all. And all in the service of the song. So I don't know whether he's 27th or whether he's 15th or 34th, but he's a really, really, really good guitar player who I would think is lives up to his reputation as one of the best of all time.
Yeah. Given what people often appreciate about guitarists, I'm actually really surprised and happy to see someone like him at like that high in Rolling Stone. And we have, obviously, from the 500 greatest albums list, we know that their rankings are absolutely like, just like they're all debatable, insanely debatable, but they're there to create podcasts for other people to. But I think that, yeah, it's, I wouldn't have been able to tell you, like I said, the first listen that he was that person necessarily. But what he actually made me think of is, I can't remember who this quote is from, but they were talking about Robbie Robertson as a mathematical guitar genius. And that the intent of the quote of that term was that while he wasn't shredding on every song, he's just incredible at adding what needs to be added at every given moment. So you hear the guitar a lot, but it never feels overpowering. And that's what this felt like for me, that a lot of the additions were really atmospheric. Like, it's just a little pop of sound at the end of a line. Like, that's in So Far Away, he does that. Your Latest Trick, he does that. Right Across the River, and those are three completely different styles of songs, but he just, you know, he's able to add that little tiny bit that makes it, you know, makes the guitar a second voice. And I think that's, you know, like that's to me the sign of someone who, like, we talk about this all the time with vocalists on this podcast, of people with really big voices just being like, I'm just gonna belt out everything. And it's like, when you find someone who says, how do I have a lot of control over this, how do I do the right thing for the song, you know, that's something special. So whether he is the one of the greatest of all time or not, I think in this album, to your point, Nathan, it's just he does what's best for the song every song. And yeah, I think that you mentioned the guitar at the start. The guitar at the Ceremony for Nothing, you know, that's obviously really iconic. Did either of you guys have like a standout kind of other bit of music or favorite bit of music that you found really interesting? Nathan, you can start this time if you want. I'll give tosses to you.
Oh shoot, I already forget. It's one with the keyboard riff. Where's the it was another big hit. I mean, that would be the other moment. Yeah. That'd be the other one. But I mean, it's really like the Money for Nothing riff casts such a large shadow. And there's something, not to get sort of too hokey, but there's something magic about that, because I like, even earlier before we recorded this podcast, I was playing it out in the living room, and my kids, who are 12 and 10, I assume they've never heard that before, but that riff kicks in and they both kind of start listening to it, and they start kind of like moving, and you know, the 10-year-old started jumping, and you know, she doesn't listen to rock and roll music, let alone from the 80s, or know anything about Mark Knopfler, but that riff, it's just captivating. And I think you'd be hard pressed to find anybody to hear when that riff kicks in that doesn't have a reaction, that would just shrug and say, it's okay. What else is on this? Like, even if that's all you care about for those 15 seconds, when you first hear it, it takes over. And there aren't many songs, you know, in the history of music that have a riff that is that iconic and that universal that spans so many generations that automatically makes ears perk up and people pay attention. So, I mean, Seven Nation Army would probably be the best example, I think, of a modern riff. But I mean, it's tough to kind of even find any other example on this album when that one is, you know, far and away the obvious choice.
Right there. All right, Adam.
Well, another thing that endears this album to me forever, I used to sing Walk of Life to my kids as a lullaby. Hmm. It's a great lullaby. I sang Yellow Submarine. I sang You Say Goodbye, I Say Hello from the Beatles, yeah. Both of those.
Hello, Goodbye.
Because they're great kids songs. They're terrific. Hello, Goodbye. Because they're great songs, but they also turn out to be pretty great kids songs if you sing them low and quiet. And Walk of Life to me is too. So, you know, Walk of Life on the album is this synth heavy 80s pop, you know, men without hats sounding thing. Mm-hmm. But it also has Knopfler's rockabilly guitar behind it. So there's still, it's like, this is country music, but with synth pop. And you know, when they play it later, if they play it live, it's a country song.
Yeah.
Unaccountably in the video unaccountably has like basketball playing in it. Very strange. The song when arranged differently becomes a different song, and that's really cool to me. I guess every song does probably, but I'm not as aware of it as I Walk of Life, which I really love. I like the different styles that the album runs across, the sort of reggae stuff that happens in it. But, you know, going out on Brothers in Arms, the sort of mournful, mm-hmm. please stop killing each other thing actually works on me. I don't know. Like, a lot of, I mean, like, that's mawkish. Like, no, it super works on me. I kind of tear up.
That's the guitar work across Brothers in Arms. And it's not like a musical moment so much, but it's like the lyrics themselves are meaningful and the production is kind of is really atmospheric. There's something about it that kind of makes you feel like you're in a place. But I don't think it carries the emotional weight of that song without that guitar work. It's got an incredible solo in it, but it fits and it just every moment. So there's that. But if I wanted to pick a non-Knopfler element to this to highlight, I think I would probably say the drums on Money for Nothing at the very start. So when they open the song, when it just builds up and it's like a cacophony at the very start. And the funny thing is, you mentioned that they use a different drummer. That is the only contribution made by Terry Williams, who is the band's actual permanent drummer, who they pushed him over to the side and they said, no, we want this jazz drummer, Omar Hakim, because we want a different sound. So you go over here, Terry. But that one little bit, and that is the one thing I pulled out. So I'd actually written that note that like, hey, this is, I love that little thing. And then stumbled upon this maybe 20 minutes before we started recording and went, oh my God.
When I put the album on for the first time in however long it's been since I've listened to it, certainly intentionally, like, oh, it's on the radio, but no, like I'm putting out the song starting and Money for Nothing comes in and there's this, the ethereal Sting stuff. Why is Sting there? What happened? That's so weird. So Sting, so they're like, oh, look, it's Sting. It's weird. And then like the guitar starts to happen. And then there's that, like that huge pay attention riff from Knopfler. And then the drums do the thing that they do. And like without even remembering that it happened, like not even noticing what's going on, I was like air drumming that riff.
Yeah.
And I'm not a drummer. I'm not a musician. But like that riff, that one, and you know, Phil Collins in the Air Tonight. Those are the two.
That's exactly what I thought of.
Well, I also thought of Won't Get Fooled Again. Like the big buildup, like duh, 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 and the Roger Daltrey shriek, like it's the same kind of buildup, but in this case, it's a guitar that kicks in instead of a shrieking vocal. But if that's his only moment, he made it count on the drums.
And I'll note now that Walk of Life is the only song on this album that I had heard ahead of time. And that's because it's literally played at every single arena when there's a NHL hockey game going on. So it's always like there's an organ version and then it might play at intermission or something. So I had heard that. And I realized that I also forgot something about when we were talking about the guitar stuff. The one thing, as someone who plays guitar extremely poorly, the one thing that did occur to me as I was watching him play is that he does finger picking. Most people would use a pick, like most guitarists use a pick. he plays with his, with all of his fingers. And I, as a result, I think it does, like, he just plays slightly differently. I think it allows you to do things that you can't do otherwise. And that that's his starting point. So I'm sure that Eric Clapton can do, can play with his fingers too. I'm sure that all the, all these big guitarists can do it, but that's his starting point. And I think it, it gives you a little bit of a different flavor to begin with. He's just a different, he's just a different type of player. And it's like someone coming in with the, they played flamenco guitar and then they eventually became, you know, in a rock band, they're going to play something different. They're going to look at songs differently. You talked a bit about the variety on this. Nathan, I'm going to ask you, I think you've already touched on it a little bit, but can you, is there any way to criticize the variety on this album? Did you said you were a bit surprised by it.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd criticize the variety. Like, it is a hard, you know, turn sort of at the middle, mm-hmm. where you're kind of getting into, but, you know, depending on your mood, I guess, really, that day that you're listening to it, it can either be sort of a nice shift or one that really kind of brings you down, because it is a very distinctly different album on the first half than it is the second half. So, yeah, again, I think it's hard to sort of make a sort of firm declaration one way or the other as to whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a very noticeable thing. And so depending on the mood I'm in when I'm listening to it, I kind of find it, if I'm not sort of, you know, amped up, it's like, finally, we get to kind of get past all this kind of loud rock and we can just sort of settle into a mood. Whereas if you're really enjoying it, like, ah, this really kind of killed the momentum we had going. So I think if nothing else, it proves that they've got the ability to do different things as opposed to kind of just straight ahead rock for 10 or 11 songs. But I guess it just depends on how you're feeling when you listen to it.
Mm-hmm. It's a weird change in the sort of narrative, the temporal narrative of an album, right? Which, like, in the, you know, up until the age of the CD, really, and certainly not in streaming, there was some art. This is arcane to me. This is occult to me, of like how you structure a whole album. And when I was reading about this, one of the things I remembered that I hadn't thought of in forever. Somebody was talking about, like, well, the song, the B-sides on this album. And of course, there's this, when you're on a vinyl record, there's this totally arbitrary distinction between, like, well, there's the songs on this side, and then there's the songs on the other side, and the songs on the A side are the first songs. There's no reason, like, there's nothing there. Like, you can play the B-side first. Nobody was coming to your house to stop you, or, like, it didn't reset or it's wrong or something. You do whatever you wanted. But there was this notion that there was this, like, temporal flow, this narrative temporal flow on an album, and there still is, but there's not the same distinction between, like, these are the A sides and the singles, and these are the B sides, because there's no such thing as that anymore. And it's especially weird because this was the first million selling CD, right? Yeah. This was a lot of people's first CD. It wasn't just me. It was recorded digitally. You know, it was designed to be audio for digital. Like, it was a transitional moment for the way people consume music. But there's still the thing of, like, the B sides are really different than the A sides.
Yeah, and I think you may or may not know this. This did come out with a CD, as you noted, a cassette, and an LP all at the same time. But the weird thing is that the LP is 10 minutes shorter. They have shorter versions of all the songs. When I read that, I was just, this is crazy. They did eventually. Years later, I think, 2006, they put out a double LP that allowed them to put the full versions of the songs out on vinyl. But before that, you couldn't hear, if you had a record player, you couldn't hear this full album the way it was intended, because it was always intended to be something that was made for, it was one of the first albums to be designed for a CD, and the cassette can hold basically the same amount of songs. So yeah, you have a 55-minute album if you've got a cassette, and you've got a 47-minute album or so when you have a record, and that seems just bonkers.
Like, you either have the version where you get the scene between Luke and Biggs back on Tatooine, or you don't.
Exactly, that's exactly what it is. Either Lucas stepped in, or he didn't. Yeah.
It's almost like a throwback to the Beatles when there was still mono and stereo before they switched all the way, and so they had the mono mixes. The band really, you know, labored over. And then when it came time to do stereo, they, you know, went to the pub or whatever, and some amateur engineer just sort of messed around with those. And those stereo versions became what were the first versions on CD. And it wasn't until recently when they reissued the mono versions, which were ones where they're like, these are the ones we really paid attention to the mix. And this was just mixed by some 20-year-old while we were out drinking because we didn't care. It's those weird kind of overlaps as technology is changing.
That's real weird. That's real weird.
So you mentioned, we've talked a little bit about the lyrics, obviously, because of the one particular word that, you know, is completely inescapable at this point. What did you think more broadly about the lyrics in this album? Did either of you have strong feelings one way or the other? Were they good? Were they boring? One review I read called them thumpingly crass attempts at wit. So, there's some strong opinions out there floating around out there. Nathan, you got a strong opinion to feed into that?
Not as strong as that, but I'd rather have attempts at wit than just sort of, you know, benign sort of, you know, Motley Crue style lyrics, which could easily fit this kind of music for the most part. So I give him credit and the group credit for, you know, attempting something deeper. And I think in a lot of cases they succeed, because again, it would be very easy to have the lyrics as a complete afterthought, given the strong melodies and the arrangements for a lot of these songs. But I found myself to be interested in the lyrics and entertained by the lyrics. There's a strong element of storytelling throughout. There's some more profound subjects. So, you know, they're not the best lyrics I've ever heard, but I think they're certainly above average.
You know, at least they ain't all love songs, you know, right? And Money for Nothing is the only song about songs. That's good.
That's good. That's very cool. Yeah.
You know, I actually think that earlier Dire Straits, which I had not heard until I went back after I had this album, are probably kind of more deeper lyrics in some way, or more poetic. You know, Telegraph Road is about some real stuff. Sultans of Swing is about some real stuff. You know, so and these are a little maybe not that, but I remembered loving then and loving now, the thing in your latest trick, looking so bereaved and so bereft. I don't know why that one works on me. Like, well, that's pretty good, man. I hope somebody had to take a break after that and go, like, you know, work their arms out. They're like, wow, I nailed bereaved and bereft and like rhymed it with "when the bottle's empty and nothing's left" later. Like, wow, that's a good day's work for a songwriter, man.
Yeah. I'm convinced throughout this entire show, I've been convinced that the people we think of as great writers are the ones who have that turn of phrase that they can pop into a song. It's not necessarily always that the whole song is incredible. It's that sometimes it's that thing, that little bit that you remember that just eats into you and you can't. But I think this album, to me, if there's a thing that is a weakness, I think it's the lyrics. And it's just they're just not consistent. You know, Money for Nothing with the obvious exception, is so fun. It's just dripping with this sarcasm and humor. The title track is, I think, excellent, but I don't think much of So Far Away or Your Latest Trick in terms of like their deeper writing. I love I Want My MTV being a, you know, an echo of Don't Stand So Close. Is it Don't Stand So Close to Me? Is that, that's what it is, yeah. Right? That's what they were playing off of. Sting actually got a writing credit on this song because it was so similar. But, you know, now look at them yo-yos. That's the way you do it. Like, it's just, you know, or, and he's up there. What's that? Hawaiian noises. He's banging on the bongos like a chimpanzee. Like, just that whole song, apart from like the, what is it? Just absolutely egregious error of judgment is fantastic. And it's hilarious to me that it's, I think it's so fantastic. And it's the one that he went to a store and the guy was saying the actual stuff and he just wrote it down. Like his story behind that is he literally was in like an appliance store or something. And a guy was complaining about bands like his, and he asked for a pencil and paper and he wrote down what the guy was saying about all of the different things. So like, that's the Hawaiian noises thing. I think he said is directly from a guy criticizing whatever was happening on MTV at that moment.
And then it gets it's an extraordinary meta involution of what then happened, right? Because of course it's Sting singing this, who's a, like, maybe the best example of the guy who you look at on screen and be like, that guy, really? And I mean, I like the Police. I don't mean to be a a dick about it, but you're like, come on. If you're that person, right? You watch the police and it's that.
Yeah.
And then like, because he says, I want my MTV, it goes into heavy rotation on MTV. It has this video that, like, this is the other thing that probably did it for me. It was like, oh, computer generated graphics.
Yeah.
Which were super new in the video. Yeah. It's like this terrible CG thing. It's like there was Tron and then there was this, you know? Yeah. And like, oh, I get. So like everything that the song criticizes happens in the song and then happens to the song.
Yeah.
Which I just love. That's like a, I don't know, that's some Douglas Adams stuff right there. That's just comedy.
When Sting actually showed up on that song, I had no idea that he was involved the first couple of times I listened to it. And I was like, this kind of sounds like Sting. Who's in this band who like is doing backing vocals here? Cause it reminded me a little bit with Queen, the drummer of Queen, I think it's Roger Taylor, I think is his name. Who, if you ever hear him sing, he sounds a lot like Rod Stewart. Like he like a lot, like, and you're like, huh, this is, so I was like, is there a guy in this band who just sounds like Sting? And nope, it's actually Sting. I should have trusted my instincts. It was Sting. It was Sting all along. We've done, okay. I think we've probably gone a little over time in this section. Anyone have anything to say about Knopfler's vocals? Did you like them? Are they too Dylan-esque? Anything else there?
I just remember, even at the time, the joke was when people would be like, what's Dire Straits like? You know, what's the singer like? The joke was, imagine if Bob Dylan could sing.
That's perfect. Because I, you know, a whole bunch of people turn off the podcast as soon as I say this, but I severely dislike Bob Dylan's voice. Like I do not like it. I hate hearing him sing anything, even old Dylan, like even before his voice just fell apart. It just annoyed me. And it felt like something that was designed to be unique in some way, but it's not, it so rarely serves the song. He sounds a bit like him, especially on Brothers in Arms and some of the other quieter ones. But he serves the song so well, and he can turn it on as soon as Money for Nothing comes on. He can turn it on, and it's still there in a way that I don't think Dylan's voice, for instance, could do.
I wonder how much of it is affect that he was trying to get at the, you know, like how intentional being Dylan-esque is for the kind of music they're trying to do. I honestly don't know, and I don't have a strong opinion about Bob Dylan. Probably even worse than having a strong opinion about Bob Dylan.
Nathan, you have strong opinions about Bob Dylan?
I do. I love Bob Dylan, but I also understand why his voice is extremely polarizing, to say the least. And yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, it's no secret that he must have been influenced by Bob Dylan as a vocalist to a certain extent. But I do think, you know, I don't mind. Like, Bob Dylan was influenced by all kinds of people. And I think
they worked together.
Yeah, exactly. So,
right before this. Yep.
I think that, you know, the Bob Dylan style works when you're a narrator almost, which on a lot of these songs he is, where he's portraying himself to be. And it didn't sort of grate on me. And I think it's clearly a bit more melodic than Dylan, which works well. So I think he found kind of a nice middle ground. I didn't mind the vocals at all.
All right. Yeah. I should note for everyone keeping score at home, Bob Dylan's 1983 album Infidels was produced by Mark Knopfler. So 2 years before this album comes out, he's working with Bob Dylan. The version that he produced, I believe, was not released. I think they ended up going back and like remixing stuff or whatever. But there is a Knopfler cut out there. Release the Knopfler cut. Hashtag release the Knopfler cut. Let's keep moving on. Favorite song. What was your favorite song, or what is your favorite song on this album? And actually, for Adam, I'm gonna ask you first. I want to know if it's the same as the one that you thought was your favorite, you know, when you first bought the album.
Man, I'm not gonna overcomplicate this. Walk of Life's my favorite song.
Okay. Do you think that was the same one as when you bought it originally, or do you think something's changed? I'm more curious than anything. I don't think you need to justify it.
Yeah. I probably bought it for Money for Nothing and then fell in love with Walk of Life, would be my guess.
I think a lot of people did. Yeah. Nathan, favorite song.
Yeah, I'd like to overcomplicate it and go with a real deep cut off the second half, just to sit, but I can't argue against Money for Nothing. I don't know what it is, but there's different layers to it. Lyrics, I think, keep it fresh for me. You talked about them being humorous, Eamon, and just kind of funny and a little bit quirky, and the guitar and the product. Like, I don't want to go so far as to say I hear something new every time, but there's things that sound kind of new every time, or things I don't focus on every time. So it still feels fresh to me. So I'm just going to go with Money for Nothing. I can't be too clever.
All right. I'm going to be clever. I'm going to go with Brothers in Arms. It's not even close to, for me. That was easily my favorite. I think there's, it really, you know, you said it, Adam, there's just certain lyrics that can get at you, and certain, you know, whether it's the music or whatever, that song for whatever reason works on me. There's so many worlds, so many suns, and we have just one world, but we live in different ones. And a song about people who are not on the same side of a conflict or on different sides of a conflict, being brothers in arms, is a really incredible piece of work, piece of writing to begin with. And then to the guitar work, I have no good sound system in my house, but my car has a fantastic sound system. So I just, going to pick up my kids from school today, I put that song on and put the sound up to the loudest that would not damage my ears, and it's just incredible, and I love it. I think you guys know the answer to this question. Do you think it was a commercial success? Yeah, no, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
I remember it. So
yeah, you remember it. Yeah, that's true. Okay, yeah. So we're talking about one of the top 25 best-selling albums of all time. They sold 30 million copies of this album. Number one Billboard 200 for 9 weeks, number one in the UK for 14 weeks, and has spent 271 weeks on the chart there. It's 9 times platinum in the US, 14 times platinum in the UK, diamond in Canada. Money for Nothing hit number one in the US, Walk of Life hit number two in the UK, and number seven in the US. Like, pretty successful, I think. Understatement, maybe.
I spent a summer working in a music store that also rented video cassettes. And was there for the summer that it stopped selling cassettes and started selling CDs. I remember people buying this album.
Yeah. you have your own tally in your own head of this did well. Every other person was buying one. Do you think it was a critical hit though?
This, I cheated because I read ahead, but it shocked me that it was not.
Yeah. Did you know, Nathan, that it was not a critical darling?
No, and that kind of surprises me. I mean, I didn't think it would be a critical darling, but I'd be surprised to hear that critics panned it. That was kind of the consensus opinion.
Yeah, it's the consensus. I mean, there's obviously a spectrum here, but a lot of the UK press, for instance, was overwhelmingly negative. For the most part, to summarize what they thought, it was that it was a sellout record, middle of the road rock, designed for commercial success. This is giving up everything this band ever stood for, kind of mentality. Like, that's what a lot of it reads as. For instance, NME, Matt Stowe from NME accused the album of the tritest would-be melodies in history, the last word in tranquilizing chord changes, the most cloying, lonesome playing, and the ultimate and transparently fake troubadour sentiment ever to ooze out of a $1 million recording studio.
I mean, dude.
Like, I know.
Really?
This is the real hazard of being a journalist, Adam. I mean, like, what's going to come back to haunt you? You know, like, what are you writing? What are you writing these days that someone 20, 30 years from now is going to be like, well, you did say this about the, yeah, whatever, whatever you happen to be covering.
You want me to bring the mood down? I'll bring the mood down. I already get to see it. I know what I was wrong about COVID. I covered COVID for most of that time. I haven't been writing about it in the last year, but like, there was, I'm like, wow, I sure got that wrong. Damn. Like, really thought people were going to like getting vaccinated. Huh. But like,
did you use similar language to this?
cloying mRNA changes at the end of every shot. If you want to hear my uninformed hypothesis about this, my stupid guess about this, I think what people heard as sellout, soporific, like uncool was that was the DX7. I think that when the synths, the 80s synths, mm-hmm. made and the transition that this album makes from like rock to pop.
Yep.
You know, that it was at that moment, again, like I remember it there, the pop stuff, the 80s pop stuff, if you were serious about music, you turned up your nose. You looked down your nose at it. Songs, specific songs and musicians that we look back at now, and even if you don't, even if you're not listening to them all the time, you think like, no, actually, they were really good.
Yeah.
Depeche Mode, right? Like, which is touring right now, in like going to tour this spring in North America, and it's $1,000 for a ticket. So yeah. Like, and that's not just a nostalgia play, because Duran Duran is not that much, believe me. I checked.
Yeah.
you know. like the I think it is that it felt poppy, but therefore yeah. it must be bad. And I don't think we feel like that anymore. I think now people sort of widely recognize that pop can be pretty fucking great.
Yeah, I think they also the expectations, right? Because like Madonna's like a Prayer comes out similar ish time. It's a couple of years later, and it gets a lot of positive reviews. And I think the expectation maybe that they'd set with earlier albums was this is the way we're going. And I tend to think about these things in one of two ways. Either you're softening your sound in order to sell albums, or you're sharpening your sound to make the best music you can make. And this is where I disagree with Kurt Cobain about, say, Nevermind, where, you know, later on when we covered In Utero earlier this season, we talked about this, that he was kind of like, well, that was... We thought that was almost a bit of a sellout, and it's like, but it's not though. It's really good music. There's a reason why it's in, I think, the top 10 of this Rolling Stone list. Nevermind is fantastic, but that's them looking at what they were doing and finding better ways of doing it. And I don't know. I think that you could take whatever they'd built before, and this is just them sharpening what they were doing before and saying, you know, it didn't match up with someone's expectations, and that's fine. But yeah, it's odd. Even now, like even in the retrospectives, I think it's sometimes they talk about the craft it takes to make a good pop record. Some of them were a bit more like it's a little uneven. You know, it's not super, super even. So I think that it's as funny. I've got this written down as fun fact. It's not a super fun fun fact, but that Knopfler himself said that this came out, and he said a lot of the press were saying we were the biggest band in the world. And there's not an accent then on the music. There's an accent on popularity, and that was part of the impetus for breaking up, was this idea of we saw ourselves as making great music, and we were told that we were just shooting for popularity, and that had problematic effect on them. So
I will say the saxophone in Your Latest Trick does have the whiff of cheese for me, and it, you know, it's a little bit like,
yeah.
I think that like saxophone used to be a thing that was pretty cool to hear in pop, and then, you know, one could argue that its appearance in You Belong to the City by Glenn Frey completely destroyed its credibility forever in pop. Because, you know, it's good in ska, and like it shows up a lot quicker. But like in that, it's a little bit of like, all right, that's a little,
yeah,
dated. That feels of a moment, I guess.
To me, that's just, it's also part of them trying, you know, a different style of music too, right? Like, I mean, that's the weird thing, is that they're being criticized for not being experimental. Then they did all these different things. Like, this is a pop album that's got a reggae song on it, a full-on rock song, a couple of songs that could be considered very poppy, a bossa nova song, you know, like folk song. Like, this is not, you know, anyway, this is a weird album for that reason. Do you agree with it being on the list, Nathan?
Yeah, and I think it's probably roughly where it should be. Like I said earlier, I don't think it breaks any new ground. You push it back for those reasons, but there are a lot of albums on this list that are there for no other reason. They sold a ton of albums, and so mm-hmm. clearly, if nothing else, this checks that box. And I think, you know, there's some really, really good songs on it. There's some really, really good playing. And so, you know, if it was in the 100 to 200 or 200 to 300, I think it's probably a little bit too high. But if it's in the 400 to 500 range, I think that's probably about where it should be.
All right, Adam.
We should all be so lucky.
Yeah.
Supposed to be in the 400 to 500 range.
Yeah.
The top 500 things
down there.
We do.
Yeah, I'd love to be in the top 500 of anything in the world. Yeah, I'm on board with it. Like you said, it's a massive seller. I think the one thing that might move it up for me, and I haven't decided yet. I've yet to decide how I actually feel about this being something that moves them up in those rankings, is the firsts associated with them. So the first CD to sell a million copies, but it's also, unless I'm mistaken, the first album entirely recorded digitally, because Knopfler was obsessed with sound quality. So it was, you know, it's something that is really unique there. So if you look at the list, if you look at the list and you're like, well, that's here because of, I always talk about Suicide by Suicide. So it's on here and I hate it. And it's there because people are like, well, no one else was doing that. They're the only people who have ever tried that. And it's like, yeah, because it was terrible and no one else wanted to do that. But if you're gonna put that on the list and give it points for that, well, I mean, can't you give this points for being someone who was very experimental, if you think about it, saying, you know what, this is going to be entirely, we're going to record this entirely digitally, is a little bit going out there on a limb. But I don't know. I also think that it's dropping right in the rankings. It was around 350 before, it's now at 418. And there's, to me, I do wonder whether it's losing relevance because of Money for Nothing and because of that one word that's there. It's not, I looked it up in Canada briefly, they talked about banning it from the airwaves. It has since been, they've been told it, or they've decided it shouldn't be banned from the airwaves, but that they would allow every individual station to determine how they would like to handle it. And it's because they came down to saying it's not hateful the way that particular word is used, but it's extremely inappropriate and insensitive. So it doesn't match our definition here of you should never be able to play this, but it's recognized as being problematic. And that's probably why for a song that's so theoretically so well known, I had basically zero exposure to that song. It's not something I've ever heard on a radio station anywhere.
Yeah, maybe that dooms it. And maybe, yeah. I don't know how I feel about that. Maybe it should.
Yeah.
Relegate stuff like that to the, like, yeah, it's a real good song, but that's a pretty big mistake.
Yeah. And something similar, Fairy Tale of New York, for instance, comes up every Christmas and also has similar language in it that they've since changed. And the band itself has acknowledged that it's problematic, but it's still, you know, that's also an interesting, it's a similar kind of case where, you know, it's of a time and it certainly does not shine today. But how do you evaluate that kind of stuff? You know, it's the Pogues have obviously changed, changed their lyrics, changed their recording. And now radios don't play that version. So it's like, if one out there that if, you know, Dire Straits had one that just said motherfucker in it, then we'd be happy, right? We'd be able to play that everywhere, but apparently they don't. So I've got one bad opinion, a one-star review from Amazon that I found. This one's titled, Only One Good Song, ... Rest Disappointing. Here it goes. I can't tell how overrated this CD is. It is very overrated and boring. If you like sexy, overrated, sad, boring music, buy this. The only good song is Money for Nothing, and it is one of my favorite songs of all time. It is pure hard rock and heavy metal, but the rest of the songs are weak and disappointing. That's from Macy Rockaway in 2006. Can't say I disagree. the very first line is, I can't tell how overrated this CD is.
Can't tell either.
Yep.
Man, as someone who, you know, doesn't not have one-star reviews for his own work on Amazon, They'll get you where it hurts.
Yeah. Sometimes there's a seed of truth to these one-star reviews. Not in this case. This case, it's totally crazy. I mean, also called Money for Nothing, Hard Rock and Heavy Metal, which is neither one of those things. Yeah. Okay, let's close this thing up. Adam, would you recommend this album to other people and why?
I would recommend it. I would have to caveat it as we have been with the one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it is even if it is just, I think it is more than just of a moment. I think it happens. I like things like this. I'm comfortable making the argument that this album exists on the tip of a pivot, that it's at this moment when like stuff's about to be like the 80s after this, like right now, this is it. Like, it's going to be like, it was the 70s before this. I got a palace. So the 70s lasted until about 1982, right? 1983. And then like, this is for like, this album is where, oh, like they played rockabilly before and now they've got synths, you know, like, yeah. You know, and that was the way everything was. It just felt like that at that time. It was like, boy, everything was like electric guitars for a minute. And now there's synthesizers everywhere. And like people are dressed like, you know, Flock of Seagulls. How'd that happen? And like, you know, this is that's the moment when stuff looked different and sounded different. Things changed. So I like it for that. And then there's just some great playing on it.
Yeah, Flock of Seagulls, another good mid to northern English band from the 80s. Nathan, would you recommend this? If so, why?
Well, I would, and here's why, Eamon. Because it's decent all the way through. There's not really an awful or a weak track. Like, there's some tracks aren't as good as others, but there's nothing that I would say is an absolute automatic must skip. It's a fun album. It's a good album. And as we've touched on multiple times throughout this podcast, it has that, you know, huge song with an absolutely iconic riff that, again, this whole thing is about Liszt, that I would say is probably one of the top five riffs in the history of recorded guitar music. And for that alone, you have to listen to it if you've never heard it before. So I would, without hesitation, recommend this.
All right. And yeah, same here. I'd give a trigger warning on that, on the language just there, in case I thought anyone was going to be offended. But, you know, it's not a perfect album. It's not always consistent, but it's excellent musicianship. Songs you'll be humming a month from now. It entertains from start to finish. That's all for today. Thank you, as always, to Nathan. A big thank you to Adam for joining us. Check out Record Roulette on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at RR Music Pod. Rate and review this podcast wherever you can. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or listen at recordroulettepodcast.com. Music in this episode is from Lemon Music Studio. Thank you for listening to Record Roulette. Until the next spin, goodbye.